Welcome for Computer Graphics. So last week we started with texture mapping. So you learned about the idea of texture mapping, which at first glance is pretty simple. When we rasterize an object, we make it visually more interesting by applying a texture. A texture is a simple image, for now, typically 2D, and it can be a photograph or can be painted by an artist or other things, which we will also learn today. And when we rasterize then an object, what we have to do is that we assign, then when we rasterize an object, we have to assign texture coordinates to the vertices of the object, and these texture coordinates will then be interpolated, and the interpolated texture coordinate tells us where to fetch the color of a single pixel during rasterization. And these texture coordinates usually are provided as part of our 3D model, so it's an additional attribute that comes with all the vertices. And we can use textures for different purposes. So in that example, we have texture for a color of the object. That's the typical case, that we compute, that we take the color of an object from such a texture. Normally, we also apply lighting. That means it's not the final color, but for instance, it's the diffuse color that we take of the normal lighting that we take from this texture. So we have the texture and the lighting on top, but there can also be very different stuff stored in the texture that should be vary over the object. And we will see other examples also today. And what we spoke about on Thursday is the interpolation of the texture coordinates. As I said, texture coordinates are applied to the vertices, and that means if we rasterize a triangle, we will have three texture coordinates for the vertices. And you learned that doing a normal linear interpolation, as we learned it for Gouraud shading, in that case will fail, or it will not fail, but it will deliver wrong results, like here. Where we see that a linear interpolation like we have here on the right obviously gives a weird result. This is what we would expect in that case. And the reason for this is that a linear interpolation on an object is not the same as a linear interpolation on its image. And that's a property of projective mappings. We can explain where that comes from. And at the end, we were also looking at a technique to solve that, for an approach that delivers a perspectively correct interpolation. That's how it is called. And the idea is that instead of interpolating attributes like texture coordinates, in this case, S and T, so here at this vertex, we have S, A, T, A. Here, this is vertex B, we have texture coordinate S, B, T, B. Here we have S, C, T, C. So these are the texture coordinates at these vertices. And instead of interpolating these, we divide these by the set value of that vertex. So the distance from the camera, the set component of that vertex, we divide that one. And additionally, we take the value 1 over set B. And you see that already looks pretty much like homogeneous coordinates, a little bit. And we interpolate then these linearly, like we learned, and then we get an interpolated S over set, T over set, 1 over set. And if we interpret this as homogeneous coordinates, then we divide by 1 over set, and then we get a perspectively correct interpolated S, T value. Okay, good. So that's doable, and in fact, we don't even have to worry about that. It makes sense to understand the concept, but if we use OpenGL or WebGL, this is done automatically. That means if we interpolate an attribute, yeah, by assigning it as a varying, yeah, so we output these values here as varyings from the vertex shader, yeah, and then during rasterization, these attributes are interpolated, and for the pixel shader, we get the interpolated value, and these values are interpolated with this approach here, yeah, so they are prospectively correctly interpolated. So that means, yeah, if we want to apply a texture, just output the texture coordinates in the vertex shader, and then in the fragment shader, we can take the interpolated texture coordinate, we will see it on the next slide, and apply it as a texture. Okay, so OpenGL supports all that well. Just generally, up to now, we were always speaking about 2D images for textures. But in fact, textures can be also 1D or 3D. And we have three-dimensional texture coordinates together with a homogeneous component. Yeah, so we have three-dimensional homogeneous texture coordinates, yeah, with four dimensions. So we can even address 3D textures. We will also see examples today. Textures can have one, two, three, or four channels. If it's one channel, then it's just a brightness or luminance value. Three-dimensional texture would be normal RGB textures, and then we can also, to both, we can add an alpha channel. So we can have textures with a transparency, with an alpha value, which, for instance, allows us to have things like if we want to render a tree, yeah, with lots of leaves. What we can do is that we model the leaves as a single quad or as two triangles and then apply a texture that has, that looks like a tree, but it's a leaf, yeah? Maybe like this. And then we apply such a texture, yeah? And by using alpha, we can cut off all these parts here, yeah? By making them transparent. Now, as you know, yeah, using alpha is a little bit tricky, yeah, but if we only use it to throw away stuff, we are fine, and we can use that even to achieve stuff like that. Yeah. Okay, so single channels, it's essentially like for images, yeah, the normal is that we have 8-bit per color component in our texture. Yeah, so 1 byte for red, green, and blue. There are also textures with higher resolution, 16 bits, or even with floating point values. And these textures can be sampled in vertex and pixel shaders using a sampler object. We will see that on the next slide. We have homogeneous texture coordinates. And newer OpenGL versions even support compressed textures. That means textures can be kept in memory in a compressed manner, not something like JPEG or so, because that's very difficult to unpack. It's other special compression formats that during rasterization directly can be addressed in uncompressed. So yeah, all that is supported. You will learn in the exercises about how to use these textures in examples, but here a short glimpse how that would look like. Textures are created in a manner like vertex buffer objects, for instance. Yeah, you know how to handle these. There, always the first step is to generate a handle, yeah, that tells us. It's just an identifier for a particular texture. This is generated using this create texture call. Yeah, this gives us a handle to a texture. Then we bind these textures. You know that also from vertex buffer objects. Yeah, so this now makes this particular texture the current texture, and then we can upload data to that texture with this command textImage2D. And yeah, it has quite some parameters. I won't detail on that here. And the image data which in our case is just an image of the HTML document if we use WebGL. Yeah, so we can take an arbitrary image of the document and by this way make it a texture. The upload is only done once, ideally the first time the texture is used. Later on, this handle is known, and then we only have to bind that texture and automatically use the already uploaded data. It's exactly like for VBOs. And now the interesting part, if one such texture is bound, yeah, in the pixel shader, we can access this texture. Yeah? And we use texture coordinates that come from the vertex shader, like you see here. The texture coordinates, now in that case, UV, yeah, sometimes they are ST is used, sometimes UV. UV coordinates arrive at the pixel shader as varyings from the vertex shader. So normally the vertex shader reads them as an attribute and just passes them as a varying to the fragment shader. The UV comes in. This UV is was computed with a good perspective correction. And then we have in the shader this called texture 2D, yeah, that reads a 2D texture, and texture is the handle or is the this sampler object here. Yeah, that's a uniform, and we can assign this uniform this texture here. Yeah, this has to be done in the code outside. Yeah, you will see it in the exercises. And then we can just access this single texture in our shader, yeah, and read the texture at coordinates UV. This gives us a color value. And then, for instance, we can multiply the computed color with this color value, yeah, and just multiply this color onto our lighting result. Okay, and to see such a result, this we will see later on. We have a simple or little demo here. Let me start like this. Okay, and here we have a very simple example, a square with a texture on it. Here you see how the texture looks like. In fact, it's a 16 by 16 image, and every second pixel of that image is set so that it looks like a checkerboard, a 16 by 16 checkerboard. Yeah, and obviously the pixels of this image are enlarged. Yeah, so each of these squares here is a single pixel in our texture. We will see effects of this enlargement of textures and even worse of shrinkage of this texture. We will see that on Thursday, or hear about that on Thursday, probably. Okay, now we can change our textures. Yeah, so this here, for instance, now this is a larger texture with larger squares. Okay, we will need that later on. That's not so interesting for now. Here we have as example a photograph of a piece of wood. So it's really a photograph. Load it as a texture, and now you see, it's still two triangles, but visually, of course, it looks more interesting. And we can even enlarge now our object. So what we do here is that we take now, that we tile these squares, to an infinite plane. In fact, we just make our square much bigger. And now we also have a problem, or an interesting problem, because now our ground plane is very big, but the texture should be in this size, so this is, for this part we have a photograph, and now we do exactly what you do if you make a floor for your living room. We take that one part here and just repeat it all over. We repeat this pattern all over, and so we can tile this entire large ground here. And this can be either done in the fragment shader. Yeah, so if we get UV coordinates, what we should do now is the following, that we say, okay, this has texture coordinates 0, 0. This has 1, 0, but for instance, this here, we take as texture coordinates 3, 3. Yeah, so that we have a continuous texture, so that we have continuous texture coordinates. Yeah? In the end, for instance, this would be minus 10, minus 10, and this would be 10, 10. And before accessing the textures, we just take the fraction after the decimal point. Yeah? So if we have a texture coordinate of 4.7, 3.3, yeah, we just throw away that part and only take the fractional part and use this as texture coordinate. Yeah, and by this we automatically tile the entire plane with our textures. Okay, but that sort of works, but you will agree it doesn't look very nice, yeah, because we can clearly see that the pattern is repeating, yeah, and in particular, because it is a photograph, obviously, yeah, the lower part here is darker, so we can clearly see that cut. A simple approach to make that a little bit better is whenever we repeat one tile here, that we mirror it, so that at least along these edges it's continuous. Yeah, we can define a pattern to mirror such that this entire thing becomes continuous. So this is better, but we can still see, yeah, that there's a repetitive structure. At least if we look like this, yeah, we can clearly recognize that this pattern is repeating. By the way, you already see here these ugly structures. I hope you can also see them on the projector here. Yeah. This is what we call aliasing, and we will come back to aliasing on Thursday, and we'll discuss how we can get rid of this. Okay, yeah, but for now, yeah, this is how these textures look like. We can also take other textures, like here, for instance, this pebble structure. And if we look at it, oops, this way, we can see the image and the perspective correct interpolation here. Okay, good. So, directly supported by OpenGL. You will learn about that also in the exercises. And you also saw probably it's very fast. Yeah, it's almost for free to apply these textures without making things slower. Now, an interesting question is, where do we get these textures from? Yeah, a typical way is to make pictures, yeah, like for the wood you've seen before. Of course, that's in particular for wood, if you want to have a floor, yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, picture camera is easy to get. You can just say, I want this pattern, take a picture, and you're done. Except this tiling problem, yeah? So how do we repeat that? But there are other textures which are called procedural textures. And these are textures that are generated on the fly. I will give you a short glimpse into procedural texturing for now, yeah? Because there are interesting concepts behind. And very often these textures are really generated on the fly. Things like wood can be generated quite well because it's still a rather regular structure and we can write programs that generate wood-like textures. Or things like clouds, as you can see here, or others. There is a large domain of research which is called texture synthesis that also belongs to this category. And here the idea is that we start with a simple image, with a small image of a texture, like this here, or we could also take this floor that we've seen before, for instance, and then we repeat this pattern not by simply tiling the entire floor like this, but by running a program that enlarges this texture and that generates a larger texture that looks similar to the input, but doesn't have this regular structure like if we would do simple tiling. Yeah, that's a very, very interesting problem, how to do that. Yeah, so the idea is just take a picture of some texture of, like for instance, the pebbles you've seen before or from grass or something like that. And then this is enlarged to a large texture without repetitive patterns, but still with the same structure. Yeah. So that's called texture synthesis. That's another approach that is used, for instance, in film industry. Yeah, if you want to use a large texture, but you cannot take a 100 by 100 square meter football ground. Yeah, you cannot photograph the entire ground, but you can photograph 1 meter by 1 meter and then just make a larger football ground from that. Okay, but let's go back. I mean, that's also kind of procedural, yeah, but for now, let's do something simpler. So for instance, let's look at such a wood texture as we've seen it before. And if we look at that, we see, okay, it has regular structure. Yeah, obviously these dark stripes, yeah, that come from the way that wood is growing. In fact, here we can even see in which direction the tree is cut. Yeah, if we would have cut the tree horizontally, then we would have round patterns. Yeah, obviously. So here it was cut this direction. So we have these stripe patterns. Yeah, and now these stripes have different thickness and also different distance. And obviously that depends on how much rain there was in this year or whether it was a hot summer. So this varies. Maybe it even varies that for a young tree, these stripes are thicker than when it's old. So the outer stripes are maybe thinner. And so the thickness varies and also the shape varies a little bit. Of course, it's not perfectly straight. Yeah, there's some variation in it. And yeah, these are things that can be modeled. Yeah, we can write a model that says, okay, let's say, yeah, we compute with random numbers, we compute the thickness of these stripes, and then we don't make them perfectly vertical, but yeah, add some variation in the thickness of these stripes. And then we say, okay, for the bright regions, we have a certain brown, for the dark regions, we have a certain brown. And then we have a number of parameters, yeah, and with these parameters, we can compute an image similar to that one. And if we change the parameters, maybe we get some other type of wood, yeah, that we say, okay, we have more variation in the thicknesses, we have other dark and bright colors, and so forth, yeah, and we add additional parameters, and maybe in the end, we can not even model oak, but also pine tree wood with that, yeah. And this is procedural texture generation. We write a program that generates these textures. This gives us more flexibility because we can change the wood with our parameters. It has the advantage that we can generate textures for arbitrary large regions. Yeah, we don't have this repetitive structure because it's all generated on the fly. The only problem is that procedural textures require compute power, yeah? And this compute power is usually done in the fragment shader, so these procedural textures are evaluated in a fragment shader. So the fragment shader computes this color. It doesn't read it from a texture like we've seen here. Yeah, here the color is just read from the texture, but instead here that code is replaced by a procedure that computes this color. And yeah, so that's a very interesting problem, how such shaders are written. In fact, that's the name where shader comes from, yeah, because it computes shading, yeah, in a procedural manner. And yeah, for such examples, probably it's rather simple. If we have much more complicated structures like this here, of course, it can become rather complicated, yeah? If we have here these structures coming from branches or so, yeah, that makes things much more complicated to do that procedurally. And just to show you an example how that could look like, I want to show an example from a web page, which is quite interesting. It's called Shader Toy. And you see it's about playing with shaders. And if you have time, go to that website. It's really interesting. It has thousands of nice little programs. And the idea always is that the entire output is generated by one single shader that is executed for every pixel in the image. And the program code, like in our exercises or like in our demos, can directly be edited here on the right. Yeah, so you can directly go into the code and play around with it. Yeah, and maybe generate new things. And in that example here, we see, I will enlarge it. Yeah, we see that that little toy train, and these textures here have been generated by such a procedural model. Yeah. And yeah, how does that work? So we always have the problem that these textures, in particular, if they are, I mean, if we have something like this checkerboard, for instance, yeah, that's very, very simple. I mean, we have black or white, and there are very clear rules when we are black and when we are in a white field. But natural objects, yeah, they have irregular structures. There's some randomness in it. Yeah, it should look organic, yeah, which is something which is difficult to describe with mathematics. So we need some way to get randomness, yeah, and organic structures. And the basis for all these are so-called noise functions. And noise functions, here we can see an example. This is marble, this vase here. Yeah, and you see it's a little bit like for the wood. So we also have such structures, but they are irregular in shape, yeah? And there is some randomness in it, and this randomness comes from so-called noise functions. So, by the way, here on the right, you can see the code for this marble, yeah? It's already quite involved. I'm sure you cannot read it, but maybe on the slides you can see it. And what are these noise functions? These noise functions are functions that generate randomness, but they are not completely random. And a first approach for a noise function simply would be that on our surface, we just take a random value for every point on the surface. Yeah, and with that one, we decide in the wood pattern whether we are in a stripe or not. Yeah, but of course, that wouldn't give us stripe patterns. Yeah, it would just give random noise, yeah? And it would give something like we see here, yeah? The single, whether a pixel is black or white, yeah, is independent of its neighborhood. This is not coherent. If we want to have stripes, yeah? If a pixel is dark, for instance, it's rather likely that the one on top and below is also dark, and less likely that it's on the right or on the left, yeah? So there is a dependency between the pixel values or a coherence. And so we need something like coherent noise, and here we can see such a coherent noise pattern. And you see it has some randomness, yeah? But it's not completely random. The colors of neighboring pixels are sort of coherent. The colors don't change very quickly or abruptly. Yeah, it's like a water surface, for instance, yeah? So the single waves, yeah, they have some structure, yeah? But they are also sort of random. And this is called coherent noise. And how could we generate such coherent noise? There's a number of approaches to generate that. Of course, we do not only have to look at the quality, but also of how fast they can be computed. For instance, all these functions involve the generation of random numbers. Oh, maybe turn that light on again, the generation of random numbers, which alone can be rather expensive in terms of computation, and also how we take these random numbers to take to generate something like this here. And probably a first approach would be that we say, okay, we take our domain and subdivide it into a grid. Yeah, so let's say this is our, this is a piece of ground or floor that we want to put a texture on, and now we apply a grid. And for each of these grid points, we determine a random value, yeah, a random color value between 0 and 1. So here we have 0.1, here we have 0.7, 0.3, 0.9, and so forth, yeah? And then we interpolate in between. Probably we do not do a linear interpolation, because then these functions don't look very nice. We make some higher order interpolation. So in 2D, in 1D, that would mean, yeah, we take random values here. And then fit something, a smooth curve, and this now is our noise function. Yeah, and we say, for instance, yeah, whenever this is above 0.5 for our wood, yeah, then we are within a dark stripe, and otherwise we are within a bright stripe. Yeah? So here we would automatically get bright or dark, bright, dark, bright. Yeah? So this is how we can use such noise functions then to generate these patterns. And with a frequency of that grid, yeah, with a grid distance, we can control the coherence, yeah, we can control the structure size, yeah, how thin are in general these stripes and so forth. Okay, that would be a first approach, but in fact, a better approach that proved to be very useful in practice is so-called Perlin noise, because it has been invented by Ken Perlin, who's a kind of pioneer of procedural texture generation. And here the idea is the following, that for these noise functions, it's not, again, a grid is taken, but now for all the grid points, the value is set to zero, but the gradient is chosen directly. Yeah, so in every point, a random gradient is chosen, and then using these gradients, the function is interpolated. Yeah. So we can see that also here. Yeah. So it's exactly the same image like I've drawn here. Yeah. So in every grid point, the function goes through zero, but the gradient is defined. Yeah. And then the curve goes here through these points. Yeah. And using these gradients. Okay, and I mean, how these interpolations and so on work is not so interesting for now. Maybe it's interesting how we generate these random values, these random gradients, because that's also a typical principle, how to generate pseudo-random numbers. The idea or the problem is that, yeah, for each of these grid points, we must be able to generate a random value, yeah? And what we do now is the following. We take the coordinates of that grid point, because it's a grid point, these are integer coordinates, yeah? So in that case, we can enumerate them 0, 1, 2, 3. Okay, no, this doesn't have a grid point. Let's take that one, yeah? So this has the coordinate 3. If we are in 2D, yeah, then we have two coordinates, and we can also do that in 3D. Then maybe we have four coordinates. And then we take these integer coordinates here and put them into a hash function. I hope you remember hashing from algorithms and data structures, in case you've heard that lecture. A hash function is a function is a value a function that takes such values here and combines them somehow to a hash value. And ideally, yeah, that's not very much correlated to that one. So if I only change whatever one digit, the hash value should become very different, ideally. Yeah, if we do hashing, then this is a required property. And this now we can also exploit to compute random values, because what we do is that in a first run, we take just a list of gradient value of gradients or of random values, yeah, a long list. Let's say 1,000. So these are 1,000, yeah? 1, 2, 3, up to 1,000. And then to compute a value at a particular grid point, we take its integer coordinates, put it through that hash function, and this gives us the index where we look into that table, and that value is the random value at this grid point, yeah? So gradients appear again and again, but totally unstructured over the entire surface. Yeah, and this is efficient. Yeah, and we can even do that more random by taking such a hash function and not applying to I, j, and k, but to apply it recursively in this way. Yeah, so we apply the hash function to k. The result, we add a j and then again apply the hash function and so forth, yeah, to even shuffle things even more around. And with this way, we can also take an arbitrary dimension of I, j, and k. And the final hash value we take to look into our table of random values. And this can be done rather efficiently. If our hash function is not too complicated, yeah, then we can compute that in a shader rather efficiently. Okay, so it looks good, and it is still rather performant. And here we see a result, how that would look like. Yeah, this function, and now here you say, okay, yeah, it is sort of random, but we still can clearly see the single squares here, right? Though the square structure of the grid is still rather well visible. Yeah, but this noise function here is really only the basis for following things. And one very often used idea now is the following. In order to not see that grid so clear and to have both large scale and small scale features, what we do is that we take such such noise functions and we increase the frequency. Yeah, so you see this is noise function on a coarse grid, finer grid, yeah, it always gets finer, and this almost looks like uncorrelated noise. Yeah, but it's just a very fine grid. And then we simply sum up all these noise functions, and then we get something like this. Yeah, this looks very much like a cloud, right? Or like, yeah, other structures. And you see both, we have large structures, yeah, that come from here, yeah, this hole in the cloud, but we also have very fine, also fine features from here. And yeah, this is called fractal noise or turbulence, yeah, because we add noise of varying frequencies up to a resolution that we say, okay, that's fine now. And this is very powerful. And you see, it looks really nice. Yeah, here we can again see how that looks like. Yeah, we take noise of low frequency, like here. Yeah, so this is Perlin noise of low frequency, higher frequency, and in fact, halved grid distance. And in fact, from here, from pattern to pattern, we always halve the grid size. Yeah. Or the distance of the grid points, yeah? So we always introduce one additional grid point in between, define a new noise function. And what also is done here is that the amplitude of the noise is reduced accordingly, yeah? So this is not, so here this noise is just reduced in amplitude accordingly from here to here when being summed up. And the result is then something like this. Yeah, you can still see the core structure of here, but also the fine detail of here, and it's all summed up together like this. This is called turbulence. Yeah. And yeah, it delivers nice results. Here we can see how that looks in a shader. So that's just a snippet of such shader code. And maybe what we can see here is that here in this loop, we loop over the scales, yeah, that's the sizes of our grid. From iteration to iteration, we halve the scale, yeah, that means yeah, we make the step size smaller and smaller until we reached a certain bound, and the bound is twice the pixel size. What does that mean? It means we generate our textures, or here the number of scales that we use, or we only go down to a scale that is still just large enough to be shown in our pixel grid. It doesn't make sense if we generate fine details that later on in our image are smaller than a single pixel. Yeah, and because we do that in a pixel shader, we know how large our pixel is. Yeah, and we just go down to a state where we say, okay, now we have all the detail generated that can be represented in the current view, and then we stop. In fact, this is a concept which we will come back on Thursday when we look at aliasing. Yeah, but this is the idea behind that. Essentially, yeah, that's the main loop that just takes this noise function here. Yeah, that's this such a noise function like this Perlin noise here. The noise function is scaled by the scale factor, and all these noise functions are multiplied by the scale, so the amplitude is varied, and all is summed up, and turbulence is then the final value. So here comes, the code here is not that interesting. The important part is that one here. Okay. Yeah, here we see the noise. Okay, and this allows us to really define a wide range of structures. So these are images of the original paper of Kent Perlin, and he used that for quite a large number of applications, like generating such a hairy ball or simulating these sun, I don't know what this is called, around the sun, these eruptions or clouds, or also to define geometry that is sort of random or looks organic, or here the marble shader that you've also seen already before. Yeah, they are all now variants, and the basis is always this noise function here. And there are still ongoing new papers about better noise functions that are faster to evaluate, that look better, that have other interesting properties. Yeah, so that's still ongoing research, how we can generate stuff like that. Here we see examples. Yeah, wood. I mean, that looks horrible. That's really only a first try. Marble. Yeah, also maybe a little bit extreme, but clouds. Yeah. That looks already good. And now let's again look at Shader Toy, yeah, because they have lots of that stuff. And if we now look into that shader for this train here in that wood shader, if we scroll a little bit down, so you see here on if you look at the scroll bar on the right, the code is really long for that one. Yeah. And the first part is this noise function. And here we see functions like hash. So these are these hash functions I was speaking about here. Yeah, these hash functions. And in fact, in this code, not only one is used, but multiple such hash functions, up to 3D. And then here we have a noise generator. That's another way. So they don't use Perlin noise, but they, in fact, they add up sine waves. Yeah. If you look at that code here, I don't know how it's generated, probably somehow automatically. Yeah. So it's just a number of random noise waves with different frequencies and offsets and whatsoever. And in the end, yeah, it generates a nice noise function. And this noise is then used as a basis for this wood shader here. So, I mean, I don't completely understand that code, of course, at first sight, but look at it. It's really very nice examples. And there are other examples. So here we can see Perlin noise, which is now changing over time. Yeah. It's the method I've shown you before. Yeah. These different turbulences added. And I mean, yeah, it's great fog, right? And try to take a picture of fog. that's impossible. Yeah. And so we have a way to generate clouds or fog or something like that with this Perlin noise. And here another example. Here now really clouds are generated. I think that looks very nice. And it even has this perspective touch. Yeah. So you see what is in front and what is in back, because stuff in front is moving faster. So I don't exactly know how they do it, but I guess, yeah, that they add up noise functions also of different frequencies, and that they move these noise functions at different speed. Yeah, so that certain structures move faster and others move slower, and those that move faster by this automatically look like they were closer. Yeah, and so we get these nice cloud structures. Okay, so these are really random examples taken from ShaderToy. Yeah, so it's not our work, but I think very impressive. And also here the code is shorter. Yeah, so be welcome to have a look and to understand how that works. Yeah, it's not so complicated. Again, here we have a noise function. Yeah, very magic, but nice. Okay. Here's another example, which is a very sophisticated wood shader. And essentially, it's like I described before. It's a shader that defines these fine structures of wood. And it even knows how a tree is growing, and you can make arbitrary intersections. Yeah. So, yeah, it has lots of parameters that allow to generate all types of wood. It comes from a modeling package. Yeah, so with just by tuning parameters, they can generate all types of wood. And I must admit, at first time when I saw that image, at first time I thought, okay, that's horrible. Yeah, there's no wood in the world looks like that. Yeah, but it's wrong. That's a real guitar. It's really, there is wood that looks like this. Yeah. And I mean, despite the colors, yeah, I think the structure is very well caught by this procedural shader here. Okay. Good. So, yeah, now we know how we can apply textures. But up to now, these textures, we always use them to compute a color for surface points. Yeah. So we have triangle meshes, yeah, and now we compute a color, and we use that color, for instance, as diffuse color or a specular color, yeah, but it's just color values that modulate our lighting somehow, yeah, so that we have visually more interesting stuff. But with textures, there's much more we can do. So just to show a few examples, for instance, one possibility is to, if we have complex structures like trees, yeah, we can simplify them using this leaf trick here, yeah, so that we, for a single leaf, we only have a single rectangle, and we cut out the leaf shape and all the structure and generate all the visual structures on the leaf using a texture. But we can make that even further, and represent a tree here by such a, that's probably a little bit too many, yeah, but taking such rectangles that intersect the tree, and for each of these rectangles a kind of tree structure is generated, and rendering all these on top, we get something that is indistinguishable from a tree or from the real 3D model. But it's, I mean, okay, that's here is exaggerated, but it's from the geometry is much simpler, yeah, because it's just rectangles with simple textures on it. And probably those of you who know old computers, computer games, know the very simple variant that a tree is represented by two rectangles that are, yeah, like this, yeah. And from certain directions, it really looks like a tree, but if it rotates, you can very quickly recognize, yeah, that it's just two rectangles. But from a far distance, it looks sort of like a tree, but yeah, it's only two rectangles, yeah. And if you take more rectangles, you get something like this. Then also stuff like clouds can be represented. And now what is done here is that the textures are not 2D, but three-dimensional. We will come back to that also in a minute. Or here is another example where clouds are represented by so-called imposters. That is, we have rectangles with a cloud texture on it, and they are just rendered in the field of view. Yeah, and because we always look, or these rectangles are always oriented towards the viewer, yeah, so that we never see from the side that the cloud is flat, but we always look at this direction, from this direction at the cloud, yeah, and so it looks like a real cloud. The disadvantage is if you rotate, yeah, then also the cloud rotates, and at some point that becomes visible. But for normal flight simulators or so, yeah, that's the perfect way to generate clouds by simple textured rectangles. Again, the disadvantage, yeah, these clouds have transparency. And you remember that for transparent objects, we need to sort them. Yeah, so before rendering these clouds, they have to be sorted back to front and then rendered in the right order. But if it's something like 100 clouds or so, that's perfectly doable. That's no problem. Okay, but there are other things that you can do with textures, or yet other things. And this is a very nice application. That a student, by the way, has sent me that picture, not because he thinks I need it. What you see here is the following. It's a screen that you can use in the solarium or when going out to the sun for tanning. And it has dark spots here, obviously. Yeah, so these are on the screen. And if you're going to the sun or if you're tanning, then these regions get less tanned than the others. And as a result, if you take away the screen, it looks like you have an enormous six-pack. But it's not from the shape, it's just from the color. Yeah? And this is a trick that we also use in computer graphics. And that's so-called normal maps. Yeah? And the idea of a normal map is that we take flat geometry, yeah, like a simple square. And now we apply or we do a lighting on that object, lighting computation, as if that surface would be much more complicated. And we control the, and we do that in the following way. So let's say, yeah, we have this shape that we want to render. Yeah, so it's a surface structure that we want to render, but we only have this geometry. Yeah, this is the six-pack. Yeah, this is the real surface. Okay, and now when rendering this surface here, yeah, this is flat, but what we can do is that for every point we take the normal of this surface, of this, yeah, like this here. Yeah, so we don't take the real normal of the surface, but we take a shading normal. Yeah? And just by that, yeah, when looking at it from this direction here, it looks like the surface has this structure here. Yeah, but In fact, the surface is still flat, and it's only for the lighting that we take another lighting normal. Yeah, and often that looks absolutely convincing. And this is called a normal map, yeah, because it is we store this in the form of a texture, but now the texture does not contain color values, yeah, RGB, but instead it contains normals, yeah. And in fact, we store it as a normal RGB texture, and we interpret R as the X component of the normal, G as the Y component, and B as the Z component. We have to take a little bit care because the components of the normals go from -1 to 1, and the values in the texture usually only go from 0 to 1. So we have to map that. Yeah, so we have to map the range from -1 to 1 to the range of 0 to 1. And if we unpack or if we read that textures, we have to map it back to the entire range again. But then we can also store normals in such a texture. Yeah. And what we then do is that in a shader, yeah, we read the texture, we unpack the normal, yeah, doing that scale, or the inverse of that scale, and then we use that normal for the lighting computation, not the normal of the vertices that are somehow interpolated like we did it last week, but we take the normal from the texture. And we will see, or I think I can directly show you the result. It's also in this demo here. Yeah, so here we see this pebble texture. It's exactly the texture that you also saw on the slides before. In fact, this is a picture, yeah, a real just normal RGB picture. And some tools like Photoshop, for instance, even support that they sort of automatically from such a picture derive a normal map. That's very heuristic. They make simple assumptions like the brighter something is, the further it is up. Yeah. But with these heuristics, they can derive from an arbitrary picture, then they can derive something like such a normal map automatically. Yeah. Many tools support that. And this normal map here has been derived from this image. Yeah. So this is an image. And normally from this image, a height map is derived. So this is a map just that describes something like depth. Yeah. Dark is deep, white is high. And from this height map, we can derive the normal map. Yeah. It's a surface. Then we have to compute the normals on this 2D surface. The formula you can see here, H is the height map here. And by using these cross products from this height map, we can derive this normal map, okay? And if we do that, yeah, and here we apply this normal map, we get this result, yeah? And now you see, maybe I exaggerated a bit the gloss, yeah? So it doesn't look like real stone, maybe it's wet stone or something like that, yeah? So we get glossy reflections, and I think it definitely doesn't look like a square, yeah? Unless you look here at the silhouette. Here you see that it's still a square. Obviously the stones don't stick out, yeah? Because it's only the normal that is changed here. Yeah, but we have this nice effect, yeah, that things look very structured and the geometry is two triangles. Very simple, of course we can make that larger, yeah? And now we have a large place. And again, these horrible patterns in the background. So keep them in mind for Thursday. Okay, and of course, we have to be a little bit careful. So we can still take our wood texture and apply this texture map, but yeah, that doesn't really make sense. Yeah, so they should fit together. Okay. That's normal mapping. There will be an exercise where you should do that. Yeah, so I don't show the code here, but one major ingredient is that we will need multiple textures in that example. Yeah, we will need an RGB texture and a normal texture. And to be able to do so, there is a concept which is called active textures or texture units. In WebGL, you have usually something like 8 texture units. That means in your fragment shader, you can sample up to 8 textures. Yeah, so you don't only have one texture bound, but multiple up to 8. And each of these textures is bound to a texture unit. And each of these samplers here, yeah, you can have as many samplers as you have texture units. So up to 8 of these samplers. And yeah, textures are activated using GL activate texture. Now here texture 0 is activated and we can bind a particular texture to texture unit 0. And here we bind one to texture unit 1, and that's the normal map. Yeah, and then in the code, we can sample the color texture and the normal texture. Yeah, so C is the color and N is the normal, and then we can do the lighting and so forth. And write our normal map program. Okay, good. So that was normal maps. So a 2D texture, and not only colors as values in these textures, but also normals. But we can also extend textures in another direction, and these are so-called volumetric textures. And these are three-dimensional textures. Yeah? And one possibility for a three-dimensional texture would be a real cloud, the clouds that we've computed or that we've seen in the examples before, were 2D textures that looked like clouds. But we can also really generate three-dimensional cloud textures, yeah, that at every 3D point give us something like a cloud density. But the problem is, yeah, these 3D things we still have to render. So we somehow have to bring them to our image. And another example would be data from CT. That's not really a rendering example. And in fact, these slides have been stolen from our medical visualization or applied visualization lecture. This is the data you get out of a CT scanner. Yeah, these CT scanner make slices, usually through the human body. And each image is a single slice. At every pixel, you have a density value, density with respect to X-ray irradiation. And you don't only get one slice, but multiple slices at a certain distance. And if you stack all these slices on top of each other, we have a three-dimensional texture, yeah, a volumetric texture. In fact, exactly the same like the cloud example, but that the cloud is a human body. Yeah? And now we can stack all these textures, and we have a three-dimensional texture. And they can be rendered maybe like this, yeah, so that we can sweep through that volume and always see a current slide, yeah, but that's of course not too realistic. But what we really want to have in the end is something like a rendering of this three-dimensional object in these 2D slices, yeah. And how can we do that? Well, if we have textures, yeah, because we don't have a rendering primitive like we have lines or triangles. We don't have volume, yeah, so we cannot render something volumetric directly. But what we can do is the following, that we take all these single slice images and generate squares or rectangles with these slice images as textures. Yeah, so we take all these slices, yeah, and generate single rectangles, and each rectangle contains the corresponding slice as a texture, including alpha values so that things also can become transparent. Yeah, all this data usually you want to visualize transparently, so that you see structures all through the object. And then we have a lot of slices. Yeah, these slices contain that data, and if we render it on top of each other, yeah, and from back to front with alpha blending, we get such a visualization. Obviously, that's not sufficient yet. Yeah, the slice distance is too big. Yeah, the distance of these slices that we generated, but if we make them this distance smaller, we get a nice volumetric rendering of that data set. Yeah. Now the problem is we have to sort them back to front. Yeah. So in that case, if we look from that direction, these slices are fine. But if we rotate now and would look here from the side, yeah, we would see these single slices again, and we could look in between these slices. So that means we need to slice that volume into the, yeah, at least three main directions. Yeah. So we have the data one slice this direction, then this direction, and then this direction. Yeah. And so forth. From whatever direction we look at the data set, yeah, we take the slice set that is most appropriate. If we look from the top, we take that one. Yeah, if we look from the left, we take that one, and if we look from the right, we take that one, roughly. Okay, and we then render the slices from back to front. The densities are transferred to transparency values, to alpha values, and we make alpha blending from back to front. And if our slices, the slice distance is small enough, we really have a volumetric thing. And this would allow us to render clouds or medical data. Or this allows us, yeah? But there is an even better way. The problem here is that we need the data now three times. We need three texture slices, yeah? Once our 3D data set sliced in this direction, in this, and in this direction, yeah? So every pixel in that volumetric data set appears three times, and we still have 2D textures, yeah? In that example. But it is possible to also define 3D textures also in OpenGL. So that means, yeah, just like we store an image, we can also upload something three-dimensional, and can say, okay, now this is a 3D texture. And to address a point in such a 3D texture, we need three texture coordinates, obviously. Yeah. And so we can take three-dimensional texture coordinates. That works. And what we can do now is that we generate slices through that volume, but they don't need to be axis aligned. We can really take slices parallel to the image plane. Yeah. So we have our volume. Okay. Our volume. Yeah. And now we make slices in parallel to our image plane. Yeah. So we really have perfectly from, sliced from back to front. And we don't have problems like here, that we always here see a little bit the transition between the slices. Yeah. So here really, really slice from back to front. And for each of these slices as texture coordinates, yeah, we just take the 3D position of that point, normalized to -1 to 1 or 0 to 1. Yeah. So this is for instance, texture coordinate 0, 0, 0. This is 1, 1, 1. And for each of these vertices, we just take its 3D position as texture coordinates, yeah? And then automatically when we render such a triangle, such an intersection, yeah, the corresponding part of the 3D texture is mapped onto this object. Yeah? And so we don't need to store the data for three times, yeah? And we can get nice volumetric renderings of that data set. Yeah, so we don't have a 3D rendering object, but with these slices, we can rather easily simulate that. But of course, it's rather expensive to do so. Yeah, if you imagine, if you look at a particular pixel, and of course, in fact, it's many more slices than we see here. Yeah, so maybe 100 slices or 200 slices. That means that every pixel is set about 200 times. Yeah, for each slice, the pixel gets a new value. Yeah. So we have very large, what we call overdraw. Every pixel is touched many, many times. Yeah. But for our latest GPUs, that's no problem at all. Yeah. And, we can by this generate our images. And whenever the object rotates, yeah, you see these slices change. And we always perfectly from back to front sample our volumetric data set. And yeah, I mean, these slides are pretty old. That's a rather old data set, but there are much more impressive data sets available that we can render with this technique today. Yeah, and it uses just the normal features of GPUs that we learned. And there's maybe one other thing. Interpolation we speak about next week. It also interpolates correctly within volumetric data set. Okay, and that's already the motivation for Thursday, not next week, but for Thursday. And before I do so, let me briefly motivate that one. Yeah, so you can maybe already think about it. Here we have our example again, a checkerboard. Yeah, and I told you that every pixel of or every field of that checkerboard is a single pixel. Yeah, and that means in the image, or when we rasterize a triangle, yeah, we have many pixels or several pixels. This is maybe one checkerboard, yeah, one checkerboard field, and then all these pixels, yeah, end up in the same pixel of our texture. Yeah, so in fact, if we compare the pixels of the texture and our screen pixels, yeah, obviously the texture pixels are larger than our screen pixels. Yeah, so we have texture magnification. And in that case, what we do is just that we take the pixel that is closest, yeah, to our point here and take the corresponding color. If we have something like this here, yeah, for now it looks good, but if we zoom in, yeah, here, at least I do, I hope you also can. Now we can see the pixel boundaries, right? That's not perfect, yeah? But what we can do is that we switch to linear interpolation. That means, yeah, we do not only take the value of the nearest pixel, but we interpolate between the surrounding values, yeah? And so we get a much smoother magnification of textures, yeah? And it's not immediately clear how big the pixels are, yeah? It's just smoother. So that's simple, but in fact, there's a probably even worse problem. By the way, this is how the checkerboard looks like if we take that linear interpolation, yeah? Probably not what we wanted, yeah? This is probably what we want. But now there's another problem, and this is if we make that larger, and we look now at distant regions, yeah? We have these very ugly patterns. Yeah, I hope you can also see them. Yeah, so here we see structures in the back that are not part, yeah, that are not part of the original grid. Yeah, so yeah, it looks very random, and then sometimes we can even see structures which are obviously wrong. They don't exist, yeah, like here these curves or things like that. Yeah, or very bad that one here. And this is a problem which we call aliasing. We already spoke about aliasing in rasterization, where we described the problem that to rasterize a line, we get these jaggies. Oops. This is also aliasing. At first sight, it looks very different from that problem here, but it's a kind of undersampling artifact. And yeah, on Thursday, we will learn how to get rid of that. And okay, that doesn't look very convincing, I must admit. Okay, but nevertheless, we will see about the theory of that and how we can get rid of this aliasing effect. And yeah, then I will finish 10 minutes early today, but I hope you can cope with that. Thanks a lot.